Hello, my name is Sam Clement, and welcome to the Picture House Podcast. Today, this is a very special mini episode where we're going to be talking to director David Lowery about his new film, The Old Man and the Gun, in cinemas right now. This is reportedly the final film from Robert Redford, the man behind Sundance and acclaimed actor and director in his own right. The cast is really incredible. The film also co-stars Sissy Spacek, Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, and it's got Tom Waits in it. He sort of stole the film for me, but it's a very, very small role, but enjoyable nonetheless. So the film is great. It's in cinemas right now, and I do recommend, after seeing the film, go on to Spotify or your music service of choice and check out the soundtrack. It's incredible. I had a really good time listening to this for the last few days. It's sort of like a softcore jazz soundtrack to accommodate this very low-key heist movie. Feels very much like a sort of a 70s classic and pays reference to a lot of Redford's previous roles, which is very nice indeed. So without further ado, I'll pass on to myself and David Lowery, who was in town for the London Film Festival a few months ago. We talked about everything related to The Old Man and the Gun. Thanks so much for talking to us today, David.
I'm so glad to be back.
Yeah, we had you on the podcast maybe just over a year ago for A Ghost Story.
Yes.
Which was in cinemas also just over a year ago.
Yeah, at that time, I think I had just finished the first cut of this film.
What's your brain like at that point where you're promoting one film, but you're actively working on another film?
It's very schizophrenic. It's very bizarre. At this time last year, I just didn't know what to make of myself as a filmmaker because A Ghost Story was so its own thing. Mm. And Old Man the Gun is so different. And so to go back and forth between the two, I just was like, what am I doing? I don't quite understand who I am. But now in retrospect, it all kind of clicks into place. And that's just something, you know, I make so many movies that overlap. Mm. I feel like that's going to be something I just need to get used to.
Your rate of work like just blows my mind. It's a film a year, isn't it? It's like Pete's Dragon, Ghost Story, Man and the Gun.
There were 3 years between Ain't Them Body Saints and Pete's Dragon. And since then, I've been trying to hit the film a year mark. And next year, it might be by the skin of my teeth, but definitely I'm trying to keep that going.
I mentioned Pete's Dragon because, of course, Robert Redford is in Pete's Dragon,
yeah,
the star of this. Is that the beginning of The Old Man and the Gun?
No, actually, he wound up appearing in Pete's Dragon because we were already working on The Old Man and the Gun, and Pete's Dragon was ready to go first. So I had a script meeting with him to talk about The Old Man and the Gun and mentioned that I was about to head down to New Zealand to start production on Pete's Dragon, and that, you know, if he had any interest, there might be a part in the script, in that script, that he might be interested in. And thankfully he was, because getting the chance to work with him as a director, working with an actor on Pete's Dragon, really made The Old Man and the Gun into something else. Mm. I learned how to direct him. I learned how to not be starstruck by him. And then also I just was able to rewrite the script for him in a very thorough fashion.
How did the script change after you had a chance to work with Robert?
I just learned how good he is with very little. He doesn't need huge monologues. He doesn't need to have huge scenes in which he emotes or gives lots of exposition, or he doesn't have to give too much of anything. Like giving him something very simple to do is one of the best things you can do, because he does so much with so little. Just a little lift of his eyebrows or like the little twitch of his mouth, like he can just sell you on anything. And so after doing Pete's Dragon, which he had big monologues and big action scenes, and realizing how much he was able to do with just a close-up, I went back to the script for The Old Man and the Gun and just pared it down. It went from being well over 120 pages to being finally what we shot, it was about 82 pages.
Oh, wow.
Because I just knew we didn't need that much. He fills up the screen like nobody else does.
You have a lot of really amazing close-ups in the film where you get to appreciate sort of the architecture of his face.
Yes.
But when he raises a smile, you can't help but fall in love with him.
You really can't. He also, I mean, he's got an amazing face. He now has a lot of history on his face as well. Mm. And he also acts for the big screen. He does so many things that when I'm sitting on set, if I'm looking at the monitor, I'll miss, because the monitor is just too small. Mm. When I'm editing, sometimes I'll miss them too because I'm looking at a tiny little window on my computer. But when you're watching him on the big screen, you see exactly how voluminous his performance is. It just fills everything up, and he knows how to utilize that space.
The film has this amazing look to it, and you shot on 16mm film?
That's correct, yes.
What was the sort of idea behind that?
I knew I wanted to shoot on film. This felt like the right type of movie to shoot on film. And 35 millimeter stock now is very clean. Now you can get a great, you know, old fashioned image out of it. You can do things to enhance the grain, but it's still very, very clean. And with Super 16 millimeter, you're never going to have a moment where you don't know that this is that it's film that you're looking at. It's just baked into the actual image. You don't have to treat it in any way. And 16 millimeter stock today, because it's advanced as well, looks about as good as 35 millimeter stock looked back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, there's obvious differences. The actual size of the image is smaller, and so it changes the way you use lenses and all of that, and the focal depth and everything. But at the same time, like, the grain structure is pretty intact. And so the image that you see is pretty much what we got out of the camera. We didn't have to do much to it. We didn't have to treat it. We didn't have to process it a certain way. It just has that baked in quality that lets you know from the get go that this was a movie that was shot on film that has that handmade texture to it. And that's something I really value.
Feels like that ties in really nicely with the history of the character.
Completely. Very much so.
And
very
his legacy so. Is such a big part of the film.
I wanted this to look like the movies that he made in like the late 60s. Downhill Racer is my favorite Robert Redford movie, and I really wanted this to feel like it was made in the same spirit as that film.
The other thing that works so well with the grain, and I actually love at the beginning of the film, there's a couple of like imperfections on the film, which is so nice that you kept those in.
You know, we were going through and looking like for hairs in the gate, and sometimes they're really annoying. You do want to paint those out because now you can, but more often than not, I just want to leave them in. I like those things. I like little scratches, little specks of dust. That makes me feel like the image I'm looking at is alive and that it's a living thing and an organism. And that's a beautiful thing because I believe films should feel alive. They should feel like they are alive and happening before you. And when you're looking at a, you know, digital image, it's fixed that way forever. When you're looking at a DCP, it's fixed that way forever. But if it was shot on film, you can at least suspend your disbelief and imagine that it's still like a chemical and emulsion all captured together, and at some point that image will decay. There's so many things that you can bring to it, and luckily, you know, for archivists, DCPs will never decay.
Yes.
But the film stock itself has that glimmer of impermanence that really matters to me.
What I like, I guess, is when you're doing digital projection of film, it's like crystal clear imperfections and
exactly,
crystal
yes.
clear grain, and you
exactly.
still get it.
But yes.
Yeah. The other thing as well is the titles. The font you use for the titles is like beautiful, so retro and perfect for this film.
It's this font called Hobo, and a guy in New York, a friend named Teddy Blanks, who's an amazing title designer, he did the titles, and he suggested we use it because it had been used in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And I thought, well, that's just too obvious. We can't just use it because it was in Butch Cassidy. And he's like, but it was also used in Little Halsey and Big Hess, which was a more obscure Redford movie that came out a few years later. And if Redford used it twice, it would just be a crying shame to not like round it out and have it be, you know, the final film of his that uses that particular font, that particular typeface. So once he laid out that argument, it was obvious we had to use Hobo. And it's delightful. I mean, it's like, it makes me laugh seeing it on the big screen. We just made it as big as we possibly could and just filled the screen with that font. And it's a beautiful font.
Yeah, it was like a nice, like, it was the beginning of the film started so well for me because I was like, amazing. It's shot on film. Great. I can see the grain. Oh, the title. Beautiful.
Yeah, exactly.
And the music comes in and Redford and Night and everything. It just, yeah, it was a very warm experience watching this film.
Everything about it was meant to be warm. It's just like, it's been described to me as a very cozy blanket of a movie. And I was like, great, that sounds perfect.
Put it on the poster.
It's a sweater movie.
Yeah. As well as Redford, you've got such an amazing cast, and we could almost just work through them name by name. But someone who we haven't seen very much on our screens is Sissy Spacek lately.
Yeah.
And she's got quite a big role in this film, which is so nice to see.
I mean, she needs to be on the big screen too. Like, I mean, she's doing great work on Castle Rock, and she's been on Bloodline, but I've missed seeing her on the big screen. And I wrote this part for her not knowing her. I just was hoping she would say yes to it because I selfishly wanted to work with her, but I also just wanted to see her on the big screen again. And thankfully she said yes, and working with her was just like a dream come true. She is every bit as nice as you would hope she would be. She's very much the Sissy Spacek like you imagine exists from having seen her in movies. She sends me pictures of, like, you know, the animals on her farm, and then whenever I get a text message from Sissy Spacek, like, I'm like, I'm getting a text message from Sissy Spacek. This is incredible. And look at these animals. They're adorable. And she lives in a farm with Jack Fisk. I can't believe this. This is just my deal, you know. And then the rest of the cat, like Tom Waits and Danny Glover, I just was like, who would I want to work with? If I could just get two guys who are going to come in for a couple days to do these small parts. And I just was like, Danny's someone I've always wanted to work with, so it'd be great to get him on board. And Tom Waits is someone who I just want to be in a room with. You know, I just want to have a phone call talking to him. And I want to hear his voice talking to me. And this was an excuse to make that happen. And it just so happened that he also wanted to do the movie. And then Casey, of course, is at this point is we've got a long-standing relationship and we just keep finding ways to make each other laugh on set. So as long as that's happening, we'll just keep working together.
I'm glad you mentioned Danny and Tom Waits, because the Over the Hill gang is like, that's amazing. What an amazing set of characters that make up that sort of motley crew.
It's, you know, in real life, the Over the Hill gang was like 20 or 30 guys. It was like a lot of hardened criminals. And I wrote a draft of the script that had that many characters in it. And it was just, it was too unwieldy. So I just boiled it down to two dudes who you just need to understand that they have a history with Forrest Tucker. And to get that history, it's helpful to have two actors who carry a lot of weight with them, who have a presence. And their presence is very different from Bob's presence, but it's a hefty presence nonetheless. And just to have all three of them in the room together was just such a treat. You know, between takes, they would just be telling each other stories. And listening to Tom Waits tell Robert Redford and Danny Glover stories about, you know, being a 13-year-old juvenile delinquent, it's just a true delight.
Would like to see all of those on the DVD, please.
I just finished them last night in my hotel room. I was cutting together the final Blu-ray features. And if you like Tom Waits, there's going to be some good Tom Waits stuff that did not make the final cut, because as soon as you turn the camera on him, you just want to keep rolling and keep rolling, and there's some real gems.
It sounds like it was a really great decision to make it just three guys, because it also makes them feel a little bit sort of like out of touch and are a little bit over the hill.
Oh yeah, you know? Totally.
Like,
yeah.
It's just these three old guys going to the bank, and they've all got their position in the heist, and that's really nice.
Exactly.
To see.
It keeps it manageable too on a production schedule.
Tom Waits, I think, leaves such a huge impact in, you know, he's not in the film for a whole bunch, but it feels like he's been with you because he's such a big character.
Yeah.
What's it like directing Tom Waits?
It was really moving to me how much he wants direction. I would have assumed that he would come to set and just be a performer, that he, as someone who has spent his life performing, he would just not think anything of it and just walk on set and improvise and just be himself. But he takes acting so seriously, and he will be sitting there, you know, 20 minutes before call time, just off to the side, just rehearsing his lines with himself, just running the lines, just making sure he's got them. And he really wants input from me as a director in what the intent was, what the meaning is, and what, you know, I would like to see. So he was really there to be directed. And I was very moved by that, because had he shown up and just, you know, said like, yeah, I know what to do. I'm gonna walk in here and say this line, and I might throw you something extra at the end of the take just to make you laugh, I'd be like, great, can't wait. But the fact that he wanted to collaborate so thoroughly on it was really, really special to me.
I'm sure a lot of people talk about this, but his story, the Christmas story he
his
tells
Christmas story, yes.
is a real sort of standout moment.
That was, as far as I know, a 100% true Tom Waits bit of autobiography. And he told me that story, and we wrote it into the script. And it has no bearing on the plot. It doesn't affect the story in any way. The movie grinds to a halt so we can pause and listen to Tom Waits tell the story. And I would be a lesser director had I not done that. Because when you're given that opportunity to stop a movie to let Tom Waits tell a story, you just got to do it.
It feels right for the type of genre you're going for as well. That sort of like throwback heist genre where there's like these character moments. And that's his character moment.
That's his character moment. And it's also, that's in many ways more important to me than the heist. I would rather hang out with Tom Waits and listen to him tell a story while he's preparing to rob a bank than to actually see the bank robbery itself. The bank robbery itself is going to be a bank robbery. And we could have shot that one and done a good job at it, but it would have been like something we've seen in a movie before, versus the three of those guys sitting in a bar. telling a story that we haven't heard before, and just like getting to like luxuriate in their presence as they all just hang out together and enjoy each other's company. That's really important to me.
I mean, you make that decision quite early on in the film, but we don't need to see the heists. We need to know they're going to do them, and we need to see that they can do them.
Yes.
And after that, like, they do a lot of them.
once you know their modus operandi, you're able to just sort of like skip past it. And I've got a perverse habit now of movies with outlaws where we don't see them actually committing the crimes, because that's the least important thing to me. I love going to a movie and seeing a great heist executed well, but when I'm making my own films, I just want to skip past that.
It's just what sets this film apart, I think, from other, you know, heist films.
Yeah, it's refreshing for me as a filmmaker and as an audience member. I hope others feel likewise.
I was wondering, but it sounds like you didn't, if you did actually shoot any other heists that didn't make it into the cut.
We didn't shoot much of anything that didn't make it into the cut. There's one scene of Tom Waits stealing a car. That isn't quite a heist, but it is also some criminal hijinks. But what we have on the Blu-ray that I was editing in my hotel room last night is an extra feature called Everything Else We Shot. And it literally is Everything Else We Shot, because so little hit the cutting room floor. The script, as I mentioned, was very, very short. And as a result, almost everything that was in the script that we filmed is in the final cut.
I think it must make for a better sort of final project if you've done all of the sort of pre-editing beforehand, and you know there's less for you to distract you when you're in the edit, or you know.
You'd think that, but we still like, you know, you may have noticed that the characters are all wearing the same clothes through the whole movie, and one of the reasons we did that, and then also the side effects of that, is that we could move every scene anywhere. So we just kept shifting things around and seeing like what happens if we put all of the sissy material in the second half of the movie. What happens if we just kept playing with it for, you know, months on end. And ultimately, it's pretty close to what was in the script, but we definitely spent a lot of time pushing scenes around.
That sounds like a really smart decision to make just straight at the top. Is that something you do on your other films, or is it something you've learned to do?
It's something I've learned to do, because I tend to, you know, put emotion and momentum and pacing over continuity. And so in my other films, there are big continuity jumps where a character will just all of a sudden be in a new outfit because I want to put a scene somewhere that it wasn't intended to be. And with this film, knowing my tendency to do that, I just thought, let's save ourselves some trouble. Let's save the actors some trouble, because they don't like changing clothes midday, and just keep them in the same thing throughout the entire movie. So Bob's always in that suit, except at the end of the movie when it is a big change for him to have a different outfit on. And the other characters are all in varying shades of the same clothes. And it just made everyone's life easier, except when we got to the edit and we realized we could do anything. We had unlimited options in terms of moving things around. Continuity was no longer an issue. But that's a luxury, actually. So I'm glad we had the ability to do that.
The film's got a very distinctive soundtrack, and it's so beautiful, and I'm sure I'll end up buying a copy like I do all of your scores. But at what point in the film do the soundtracks come in for you?
Well, Daniel Hart comes to set. He reads the script from the very first draft, and then he'll come to set and hang out and just watch us shoot for a couple of days. And I know that at that point, he's thinking of things. He's coming up with ideas. He's listening to the sound of the actors' voices. He's listening to the rhythm at which they're performing their lines, watching how we're shooting the scenes. And I always throw out, you know, random ideas. Like with this film, I said to him that, you know, I think there should be a lot of percussion in the score. And at one point I felt like, you know, this movie feels like it could have like a Mark Knopfler, like 1980s, like local hero style score. And I'll throw out references like that, and he'll take those and process them however he sees fit. And then at a certain point, he'll start sending me music. With this film, he suggested that we explore a sort of jazz-influenced score. And that was something I'd never done before. It was, you know, he's very well versed in jazz, but his scores have never dabbled in that much. So it was a new experience for me. And I just was like, sure, let's try something that neither of us have ever done before. This is going to be great. Bob loves jazz. It'll make him happy. And it just felt right for the movie. I don't know. I feel like this time last year, when we last spoke, we had a pretty good cut of the movie. You know, I cut the movie without any temp score. I just tried to find the rhythm of it within the form of the movie, with the form of the film itself. And I'd probably just started getting music from him. 98% of what he gives us is always right out the gate. that's one of the great joys of working with him. And that's why I always will work with him, is because he just understands what the movie needs on a level that's so intrinsic that he can just give us music that just feels like what the movie has needed all along. And we don't have to do too many revisions on it. And of course, we do revisions on it, and we try out lots of different things and move the music around and push it from one scene to the next. As soon as I hear, whenever I hear his music for the first time, I'm like, oh, that's exactly what the movie's needed. And I just didn't know it until now.
That's brilliant. Well, thanks so much for talking to us today, David.
Thank you. It's been so great to be back.
We can't wait to play the film in cinemas. I think people will love it. And it comes out just before Christmas here. And it's like the perfect thing to watch.
It's like the perfect movie to go see over the holidays with your family, because it's a movie that every generation can enjoy.
We'll see you for the next one.
Can't wait. I'll be back soon.